Hello and welcome once again, podcasters, to this series brought to you by Kilkenny Library Services in association with the Government's Decade of Centenaries Initiative. My name is Owen Swinton Welch, and in these podcasts we focus on revolutionary era Kilkenny. Today, over the course of two podcasts, I'm going to discuss the events leading up to the altercation in Knocknagress near Tullerone, which left two men dead. Here, two members of the West Kilkenny Flying Column met their demise, receiving fatal wounds on Friday the 13th of May. However, in today's podcast, I thought it was a perfect opportunity to look at the background of the men who met their end that day in May. What I mean is to take a look at the backgrounds of Sean Quinn and Pat Welsh to try and understand how they ended up fighting for their lives in the fields of Tullerone. Indeed, the two men, I think, are a perfect case study, as they both came from very, very different backgrounds. I think sometimes we do focus a little too much on how people of this era met their end. I often think to myself, if I was in their shoes, I would like people to remember much more how I lived my life beforehand and not how it finished up. So that is to ask the overall question, what drove these young men to join the IRA and later a flying column with the goal of freeing their country? Indeed, this is a question or a case study that could be applied to any of the men and women of this era. So that's where I'll start today, the life and times of Pat Welsh and Sean Quinn, if you will. And then in the second podcast, I will cover what actually happened in their final days. So I start with Pat Welsh. He was born in Dunamagan village on the 4th of May, 1887. So to give us some context, that's just 3 years after what would become his beloved GAA was founded. His parents were Matthew Welsh and Mary O'Neill, or Nail, as they say in that part of the woods. Pat was named after his grandfathers, both of whom were named Patrick, although both of these men were deceased before he was born. Pat was very much a honeymoon baby, arriving just 9 months after his parents got married. Unusually for the time, Pat would be Matthew and Mary's only child. Of course, we don't know the reason why they only had one child. That wouldn't have been talked about. But Mary was relatively older upon marriage, aged in her late 30s. Now, I know that's not old nowadays, but it was relatively older for females to be getting married at that time. That was in stark contrast with men who often married late, much like Matthew, Pat's dad, who was near 40 upon marriage. But it's easy to imagine that Pat must have been the apple of his parents' eyes. Matthew and Mary both came from publican backgrounds, so they were a great match. It was Mary who brought the shop and the pub to the marriage. She was from the main street in Dunamagan, and Matthew was from the nearby village of Newmarket, which is near Huggenstown in October. They settled in Dunamagan's in Mary's place. So relative to the time, they had quite a comfortable life, although of course it would have been hard work as they were working morning and night between the shop and the pub. It did, however, afford Pat the luxury of continuing his education beyond primary school. Pat's father, Matthew, had spent some time in America before returning to Ireland. He had seen a bit of the world, so to speak, where many of his contemporaries would have never left the county in their lifetimes, let alone the country. So it's more than possible that he encouraged his son to progress and think outside the box a bit. The majority of kids wouldn't have gone beyond primary education at this time, as it cost money to go to secondary school then. The fact Pat was an only child must also have helped, as there was no children coming behind him to provide for. Pat completed his primary education in the local Barrascoop National School, which no longer exists and was located at the crossroads, or Barrascoop crossroads, people would know from that area, that leads into Dunamagan village. He then went to Kells National School for a period, kind of as a teacher's assistant, as an intermediary step, before attending the Christian Brothers Secondary School in Callan. By all accounts, he was a very smart and confident student. After his schooling, he returned home and helped his parents with the family business. He immediately got involved in every and any local activity he could get stuck into. It's from the time he finishes school that he gets involved in the cultural movements that were sweeping across the country at the time. Basically, there was a craze for all things Irish in the early 1900s. It is often referred to as the Cultural Revolution by historians. Indeed, many have posed the question, would the political, social and militaristic revolutions have happened to the same extent without the cultural one that preceded it? Pat was on the committee that set up a Gaelic League club in Dunamagan. This was to allow the locals, including himself, to learn the Irish language, which he wouldn't have been taught in school as it was not on the curriculum. In this regard, he may have been influenced by the Christian Brothers in Callan, who were very much into the cultural revival taking place. Pat also started playing Gaelic football for Dunamagan and then became one of the founding members of the Dunamagan Hurling Club. The clubs were then known as the Glory Rovers. This was in reference to the small river Glory that flows through the village, and incidentally, it flowed only a few yards from where Pat was born and raised. By the age of 21, Pat was already refereeing matches for the GAA and then became a Southern Board delegate for the Kilkenny County Board. Notwithstanding his very young age, he was confident enough to be very vocal at meetings he attended. In one of his referees' reports to the Southern County Board in 1917, he castigated the Coffsgrange hurling team, calling them ruffians. In the final of the Kells tournament played between them and near neighbours Folkestown, both places are not that far from Kilkenny, CC that is, he said players on the Coffsgrange team punched his two umpires, Ray Cody and Pat Haw. The Coffsgrange defenders believed a point had been scored, but the umpires awarded a goal to Folkestown. Indeed, Pat himself could have received a blow except for the intervention of a young student who was studying for the priesthood. In his report, Pat said the following to the Southern Board, quote, I have never seen anything to equal the Coffsgrange team. They were prepared to down everybody who intervened in the interests of peace. I hope the county committee will adopt strong measures to put an end to such reprehensible conduct, which I can describe by no milder term than downright ruffianism. End quote. It should be noted that these leadership roles Pat appeared to take on were very much helped by his circumstances. He was a highly educated young man when compared to his contemporaries. He was also more or less self-employed. Although the family business took his time, he had his parents to fall back on when he was at meetings or matches. The most important industry in the area at this time was farming, which was very inflexible, physical and time-consuming work, especially in the spring and the summer months. Pat had the luxury of not having to do that. He had his finger in so many pies he was nearly constantly at one committee meeting or the other. In 1915, however, sadness descended onto the Welsh household. Pat suffered a loss of his mother and Matthew, his wife, when Mary died on the 25th of March, aged just 68 years. Pat was 27 at the time. It should be said also that during this period, Pat was very much aided and abetted in his activities by the local curate, Father Thomas Hennebury, who arrived in Dunamagan in 1916. Not that Pat needed much coaching in that regard. Father Hennebury lived just across the road from Pat and they became good friends. Both men became very close to Father Patrick Delahunty, then a curate in Callan, who was originally from Munkine. Father Delahunty would go on to become known as the Rebel Priest, as he became vocal in the preaching of the new Sinn Féin gospel in South Kilkenny, much to the annoyance of the local bishop. It is fair to say that Pat and his two religious friends, along with the majority of the Kilkenny populace, would have been supportive of the more general nationalist movement prior to 1916. That was led by John Redmond et al. However, following the 1916 rising and its aftermath, attitudes regarding Irish independence changed rapidly. It was in this fervent atmosphere, along with a strong anti-First World War feeling, where young men were fearful they were going to be conscripted into the army, that Pat Welch revitalised the Sinn Féin Club in Dunamagan in 1917. This was a political club where people could come to discuss the new ideas of the time. On New Year's Day 1917, Pat, along with Father Hennebury, organised a benefit night in the parish hall in Dunamagan. The concert was in aid of, amongst other things, the Irish Prisoners and Dependence Fund. The local RIC went to the concert and took down the names of those who were participating, paying particular attention to Father Delahunty, who finished the night by singing rebel songs, which were classed as being against the Defence of the Realm Act, or DORA for short. This was a law which was in place during the First World War. Roughly speaking, singing rebel songs could be considered treasonous against the king and also likely to incite disaffection, as they termed it. It's amazing to think that the treasonous song in question, Who Fears to Speak of Easter Week, it was noteworthy in that the rising had only happened 9 months previously, but it had already been positioned as a key event in Irish history. Father Pat had sung five verses of that song, by the way, as reported by the RIC, and which no doubt made its way to the bishop. In June 1917, Pat and Father Hennebery were the Dunamagan representatives in Kilkenny City at a massive meeting of all the Kilkenny Sinn Féin clubs. Arthur Griffith, the founder of the original Sinn Féin, spoke at this meeting in City Hall, which undoubtedly inspired Pat and everyone else present. Pat quickly followed the founding of a local Sinn Féin club in Dunamagan with the founding of a company of the Irish Volunteers, or the Irish Republican Army as they became known in 1919. The majority of the young men in the local village joined this organisation, where they learned signalling, first aid, drilling, with hurleys usually, which were used as makeshift rifles, amongst other tasks. Pat was elected captain or leader of the Dunamagan Irish Volunteer Company. The Dunamagan Company was known as B Company. It was initially in the 7th Battalion, headquartered in Callan, but it was later incorporated into a new 8th Battalion of the Kilkenny Brigade. I know to us looking at this at 100 years remove, companies and battalions mightn't mean much, but to these men, it was important. Think of it in terms of a local GA club, where there was often a healthy rivalry between companies and battalions in regards to how good they were doing, but then at county level, they were all in it together. As can be expected, the training, drilling and education varied from company to company. B Company, that's the Dunamagan, worked closely with F Company, which was based in the neighbouring village of Kilmaganny. Pat learned much of the military side of things from Antoglock magazine, which was the official Irish Volunteer magazine which he subscribed to. In April 1918, when the British government agreed to conscript Irishmen into the British Army to fight in the First World War, there was a widespread protest against the move. The Dunamagan Irish Volunteer Company, led by Pat, was one of the companies to parade in protest against conscription. Any young men who hadn't joined the volunteers previously quickly joined up the protest against having to be forced to join the British Army. Thus, the membership of the company increased dramatically at this time. The locals of Dunamagan also took part in Gaelic Sunday in August 1918. This was a nationwide protest where GA matches were organised all over the country on the exact same day at the exact same time in protest against the British government, who had requested that all GA matches would have to get a permit from the RAC before being played. Pat was refereeing that day and everything went off without a hitch, as the RAC could never cover the amount of games that were taking place. So just to recap, even before the huge changes in attitude in Irish society in regards to independence after 1916, Pat Welsh by this stage was already a relatively well-known young man, especially in South Kilkenny. The aftermath of the rioting was a huge turning point in his life, like it was for so many of the revolutionary generation. And if you think about this, Pat was now, at this stage, involved in leadership roles in the full spectrum of nationalist organisations that existed in the era, just to list the main ones. In the military sphere, he was captain of the local Irish Volunteer Company. On the political front, he was on the Sinn Féin executive in the area. And in the cultural sphere, he was heavily involved in the Gaelic League and the GAA. In January 1919, just as the War of Independence was kicking off, Pat, in his position as secretary of the Dunamagan Sinn Féin Club, wrote to Isaac Bell, the leader of the Kilkenny Hunt. He told Bell that himself and his hunt were not welcome in Dunamagan, and if they tried to venture into the Dunamagan, they would be stopped by the Irish Volunteers. This was a nationwide campaign that Sinn Féin clubs were involved in, protest against the incarceration of Irish prisoners without trial in the fake German plot conspiracy of the previous May. Pat went from strength to strength in the Sinn Féin movement. He was elected vice president of South Kilkenny Sinn Féin, along with Father Delahunty, who was elected president. Father Hennebery was elected honorary secretary, so they're all involved in it together. In March 1920, Pat got his first taste of real military action when he was one of the party of 30 plus men who attacked Hugginstown RAC barracks, which is about 5 miles from Dunamagan. Led by Tom Tracy and a bombing party led by Joe McMahon, the RAC constables inside the barracks surrendered. This was the first capture of an RAC barracks in Leinster in the War of Independence era, so it was a massive coup for the IRA. That event is covered in detail in another podcast.
During the summer of 1920, Pat organised raids for arms in the local area. This was an order from IRA GHQ with the aim of increasing the arsenal of the local companies. At the end of August 1920, Pat was in charge of a group that were raiding for arms in Kells, and that's the next village over from Dunamagan. The owner of that house opened fire on the raiding party. Pat escaped injury, but Dennis Lahart, one of his men, was injured, having received shotgun wounds to his legs, shoulders and stomach. At this time, there was something of a saga as well about the destruction of Kilmaganny Courthouse. It was initially meant to be destroyed in the spring of 1920, but representations were made not to have it destroyed by the owner of the building, Mrs. Moore, who was considered an IRA sympathiser. She had also owned the building the police barracks was housed in across the road before it was evacuated. That building was destroyed on Easter Sunday night, 1920. Miss Moore had friends in high places. A letter was sent to Michael Collins, which still survives in the archives, from Áine Ceant, who was the widow of executed 1916 leader Éamon Ceant. In it, Áine explained that Mrs. Moore would have no rental income if the courthouse was destroyed, along with the barracks. At the time, the RAC usually rented their barrack premises from a local landlord. Michael Collins then wrote to the Kilkenny IRA Brigade Commandant, ordering him not to destroy the courthouse. Pat Welch's luck in avoiding arrest ran out on the 8th of December 1920, the Holy Day. His house had been raided by the RIC and auxiliaries on four occasions prior to this, but nothing incriminating was ever found. However, that changed on this occasion. In a crevice in the stone wall of an outbuilding, the Crown Forces found seven copies of An Toghlach, the Irish Volunteer magazine, and two certificates for Dáil loans. Pat was arrested in a pub nearby and brought back to his house, where the incriminating documents were found and it was shown to him. He was then brought to Callan Barracks. From here, he was sent to Waterford City Prison. He spent his last Christmas in jail. During his military court-martial at the end of January 1921, he decided to defend himself. This was somewhat uncommon, as IRA prisoners in these circumstances usually just gave the response that they did not recognise the court. He made a very good fist of defending himself, however. He could easily have been a barrister in another life. In a nutshell, he basically implied that the documents seized at his home were planted there. This is not an unfathomable thought. Pat more or less implied that he was not stupid enough to leave things like that in his own house, especially since he had been raided on four previous occasions. Indeed, he said the loans and magazines dated from the previous March and April, and the house was raided since then and nothing was ever found. In addition, the material in question was found outside and not in his actual house, so he made the point, and it's a valid point enough, that it could easily have been planted there. He also argued that it was a bit convenient that the Crown Force search party were drawn directly to that particular crevice in the wall. This is all to no avail, however, and he was sentenced to 84 days in prison with hard labour. The prison register gives us a little detail about his physical appearance, which I think humanises him more in one's mind. He's described as being 5'10", which was a relatively tall for that time. The average height for men in those days was about 5'6". The difference between now and then is mainly due to diets and healthcare. The average height of women, by the way, at the time was just above 5 feet. In the register, Pat was recorded as having blue eyes and having foxy hair. The prisoners were at that time stripped and examined closely on admission to prison for the purpose of locating any distinguishing marks or tattoos, which were then recorded. This was in case they were ever admitted again, or tried to use a pseudonym at some stage in the future, or perhaps tried to change their identity with another prisoner whilst in prison. It was noted that Pat had a slight scar on the right thumb and he had a mole on his left hip. Pat Welch was released from prison on the 18th of April 1921, just 1 month before his passing. And we will pick up what happened to Pat in the last few weeks of his life in the next podcast. But now we will turn our attention to the other man that fell mortally wounded by Pat's side that day in 1921 in the hills of Tullerone, that being Sean or John or Jack Quinn. One of the reasons I chose these two men as a little case study of the era is because their backgrounds are so different. And that's not just the age difference. Pat being 12 years older than Dan Sean. Pat was 34 in May 1921 to Sean's 22. Indeed, Sean Quinn's background doesn't fit the usual profile of an IRA combatant of this era. Even allowing for Sean being younger, we have much less information about him simply because the records don't exist. This is mainly due to Sean's life circumstances having a very different path through life when compared to Pat. Sean had a tough upbringing. Sean, or John Paul Quinn as he was christened, was born at Bishop Gates Street, Mullingar, County Westmeath, on the 27th of July 1898. His father was William Quinn, who was a butcher by trade, and his mother was Lizzie Quinn, née Dolan. When Sean was only 1.5 years old, on the 28th of December 1900, his father died of a heart complaint, aged just 34. Even more tragic was that Lizzie, Sean's mother, was 6 months pregnant at the time. She gave birth in March 1901 to another son, whom she named William after his deceased father. In a time before social benefits, and at a time where most mothers did not work outside the home, Lizzie was required to move in with her own mother and brothers in St. Patrick's Terrace, Mullingar. It is likely she couldn't pay the rent now her husband had died. It really must have been a very tough life for Lizzie, with her husband now gone, having two children under the age of two, and the realisation that she was a widow at just 26 years of age. When Sean was still a young boy, he was sent to Fairy House Industrial School in Clamel, run by the Rosminian fathers, to ease pressure on his mother. Now, it is not known how the decision was made or how it came about. If a priest or a doctor recommended this, the mother would have very little choice in the matter. And just to be aware, an industrial school was considered a good option at the time, as the children would be fed, clothed and educated, with an apprenticeship likely at the end of it. There was a little or no talk about abuse, physical or sexual, at the time in these schools. Also, in the lingo of the time, Sean was classed as an orphan simply because his father, the main breadwinner, had died. He wouldn't have been stuck for company in Fairy House though, as there was about 150 kids there at any one time. Always having someone around to play with helped him excel at Gaelic football, which he became very proficient at. Following his education, he was apprenticed as a baker aged 16, firstly in Clonmel and later in Mullinahone, County Tipperary. Now, this wasn't a million miles away from his roots. His father and most of his uncles on his mother's side, the Dolan brothers, served their time as butchers. However, Sean didn't like the baking trade, and it was said he wanted to be outdoors. After leaving his apprenticeship, he took up farm labouring, which he seemed to enjoy more. In Mullinahone, he joined the local GAA team, winning championship football medals. Tipperary at the time was, of course, a very strong football county. He also joined the local IRA company in Mullinahone, which was part of the Kilkenny Brigade, due to its geographical location very close to Callan. In late 1920, he joined the West Kilkenny Flying Column and was one of those who escaped from the famous Scarry Ricken Shoes House in March 1920, which we covered in a previous podcast. However, on Friday the 13th of May 1921, his luck ran out. I think that is where we leave it there today. After covering the lives of these two gentlemen, in part two of this podcast, I will describe what happened to them and the rest of the Flying Column in the final weeks of their lives. Join me again to discover their fate. Until then, goodbye and thanks for listening.